Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. On today's program, legislators are seeking to keep coal-fired power plants running a little longer, but some are doubtful that's possible.
If the current owner can't make money with that business model, I don't see how anyone else coming into it would.
Wyoming's legislature passed blockchain legislation that seems to be paying off.
The blockchain task force work has probably accomplished more to diversify the economy of Wyoming than the Endow Initiative.
And as the climate warms, ice fishermen are tiptoeing on thinner and thinner ice. Some advice from the pros on staying safe.
But I've also seen it where, like last year, I didn't feel that we were safe enough to go out fishing.
Plus stories about moose, condors, and grizzlies. All that and more coming your way on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Utilities continue to shutter coal-fired power plants at near all-time highs. Last year, two more states committed to 100% clean energy, another blow for coal. Now, Wyoming is pushing back. It just passed a bill seeking to keep those plants alive a little bit longer. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim explains.
Early one November morning last year, Devil's Tower Senator Ogden Driscoll got a call from another legislator.
He discovered that Rocky Mountain Power was accelerating closure of a number of their coal-fired units down around Kemmerer in his district.
Driscoll learned the utility was discussing plans to accelerate the shutdown of the Naughton Power Plant and possibly others, though a representative says no plans are finalized yet. Last year, the plant's owner, PacifiCorp, announced more than half its coal-fired units were more expensive to run than alternative energies. Driscoll says the potential early closures don't really seem like they're about economics, though.
My gut reaction is there's a huge unwillingness to purchase coal-fired energy on the West Coast. They're flexing their muscles.
And Driscoll says an early closure would have huge impacts on communities.
It's not just the effects are on the company itself. It's the effects on housing and workforce and tax bases in entire counties. You know, there's 1,000-plus jobs tied to those plants.
So Driscoll co-sponsored a bill to keep coal plants running. It's called New Opportunities for Wyoming Coal-Fired Generation. And basically what it does is require utilities to look for a new owner before shutting down a coal unit, whether that's shutting down for good or switching over to renewables or gas. And if the utility gets a reasonable offer, they're required to take it, then buy back that power, even though it's not their plant anymore.
It encourages someone to go do the right thing, and the right thing is to keep those producing power the way they were forecast.
The bill went through both the House and Senate with little discussion. The consensus among legislators was that plants would probably not get bought, even with the requirement. But if they do, great. No harm, no foul. Not everyone felt that way.
I was disappointed that there wasn't a more robust discussion of this bill. What kind of a can of worms are we actually opening?
That's Connie Wilbert, the Sierra Club's Wyoming director. She says the bill could absolutely cause harm and foul if a plant gets bought.
What it could do is lock Wyoming ratepayers into much higher prices for their electricity for years to come.
That's because customers would be on the hook for a higher percentage of power produced in these plants. And Wilbert says there's risk if a utility sells to an unregulated buyer, like less certainty about guaranteeing workers' benefits or reclamation costs for the land. Wilbert sees the bill as an attempt to prop up coal.
What this bill is an attempt to force utilities to not sell these old, uneconomical coal plants. It's a very challenging transition that we face, but we face it. Trying to ignore it or pretend like it isn't real is not actually going to solve our problems.
University of Texas Energy Institute's Joshua Rhodes says the bill is unlikely to keep coal plants running.
I can't think of anyone who would want to line up to buy it. If the current owner can't make money with that business model, I don't see how anyone else coming into it would.
Unless, he says, the plant were able to be sold at a low enough price. Another coal expert, Matt Preston, says there are other possible uses for the plants, especially with an unregulated buyer, like in testing out carbon capture technologies. He He says that buyer could take advantage of federal carbon capture tax credits. Both Preston and Rhodes agree, though, the bill likely won't be enough to keep coal plants alive, but it may act as a gut check before utilities close the doors. Here's Preston.
It's sort of to plant the idea in the head that they shouldn't willy-nilly retire coal plants. Not that you shouldn't or couldn't, it's just that you need to think about it when you do it, and you should do it for the right reasons, not perhaps political reasons.
Laramie Senator Chris Rothfuss says he agrees the bill won't somehow save coal. He voted for it, though, after initial skepticism.
Yeah, I don't think the piece of legislation we passed solves any problems. It's unlikely to probably even end up getting used in any meaningful way, although if it does, maybe there's a beneficial outcome.
Rocky Mountain Power hasn't announced any early plant retirements yet, but will release a complete analysis on its fleet this summer. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
While the Wyoming legislature was busy fighting about private schools, the budget, and a few tax issues, it also passed legislation that continues to make the state the place to be for blockchain technology. While it didn't get a lot of attention in Wyoming, those new laws are getting worldwide attention. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
Blockchain is a digital ledger that can be accessed instantly. It's most commonly used in the financial world, where digital money can be transferred back and forth without delay. But blockchain can be used for other things as well. We'll get to that later. This session, the legislature passed a law making Wyoming the first state to recognize cryptocurrencies as money, and also allow depositories, which are like banks, to come to the state and store the digital assets. Caitlin Long is a Wyoming native with a long history on Wall Street and is the co-chair of the Wyoming Blockchain Coalition.
This was one where being first actually really does matter, because we could grab a first mover advantage, and it's pretty clearly starting to play out that way.
Long says it's hard to overstate the interest in what Wyoming is doing.
I've had thousands of inquiries personally through social media just in the past 2 weeks. And when I published a piece on Forbes.com 2 days ago that summarizes the importance of the legislation, within 24 hours, it had 22,000 views.
That's not a surprise to Laramie Senator Chris Rothfuss, who says the worldwide interest has been high ever since Wyoming embarked on this effort.
Of all the years that I've been on the legislature, this is the first time that I've been in a committee where people fly from all over the world to participate, where we have billionaires sitting in the back of the room to provide testimony on what it is that we're working on, where we receive unsolicited advice from law firms on the East Coast that work in securities.
Recognizing digital assets was huge for Wyoming, but he says the so-called digital banks bill was equally big. That's because specialized banks are needed to store digital money.
That allows these innovative and kind of advanced startups to be able to bank and pay their paycheck.
Already several of these repositories are looking to set up shop in Wyoming. Sheridan Representative Cyrus Western says the need is great.
Goldman Sachs issued a white paper back last summer that said, you know, there's about $110 trillion worth of securities floating around on the global market, of which they think in the next five or so years, 10% of that's going to be shift or migrate towards blockchain. So we're talking well over $10 trillion is going to be needed to store it somewhere.
Western says the main exchange in the digital currency world is paying close attention.
The founder and CEO of Kraken, which is one of the big Bitcoin exchanges, I think they've got like 6 or 7 million users. You know, they were here because they were extremely interested and are strongly considering moving their operations to Wyoming. And I think this is a company with like 700 employees. When you need to get people like that knocking on your door, something's going right.
Sundance Representative Tyler Lindholm says helping legislators understand the importance of this has taken some time and education, but he says businesses get it.
We had a business last year that got a hold of us after our first round of legislation and let us know that their headquarters were officially moving from New York City to Jackson. I don't know that that's ever happened.
Lindholm says the blockchain opportunities are not limited to finance either. Wyoming has developed BeefChain, where Wyoming cattle and beef products can be tracked globally. He notes that Walmart used blockchain during the romaine lettuce scare. At first, it took 7 days to figure out where the produce came from. But after developing a blockchain technology, the information is available immediately.
So 2.2 seconds are able to trace directly back to where that food comes from. So on a foodborne illness aspect, the technology is wonderful. On a regulatory aspect, as good as it can be.
Rothfuss says entrepreneurs are flowing into the state, developing all kinds of technologies.
We are already seeing innovative technologies being explored in the state of Wyoming and effectively beta testing them here so that they can then develop a product to the rest of the country.
Rothfuss adds this is happening with little spending from the state.
The blockchain task force work has probably accomplished more to diversify the economy of Wyoming than the Endow Initiative.
Rothfuss and others are now going to wait and see what happens. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Next on the show, we'll hear about an effort to overhaul the nation's election and ethics laws, and a new Smithsonian Channel series on Yellowstone. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. House Democrats are pushing an effort to overhaul the nation's election and ethics laws. But Wyoming Republicans say the effort is a smokescreen to help keep Democrats in power. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
The measure in the House is dubbed H.R. 1, or House Resolution 1, a coveted and symbolic number, marking that this is Democrats' top priority. And it's a grab bag of different items that Democrats have wanted for years, like efforts to make the government more transparent and to get corporate PAC money out of politics. Wyoming Senator John Barrasso is not impressed. He says one of its worst provisions is to allow matching public financing of congressional campaigns, along with other mandates included in the measure.
The people of Wyoming are not going to support full government funding of elections. We're not going to support Washington coming in and telling us how to run our elections. The people of Wyoming know how to do it, and we don't need help from Washington on doing it. We've been doing it well for our entire history of statehood. The last thing we need is Washington coming in and telling Wyoming folks how to vote.
While President Trump's own election fraud commission came back empty-handed after they looked for patterns of illegal voting nationwide in 2016, last year, a North Carolina Republican candidate hired a man who allegedly engaged in voter fraud, so the state needs to hold another election this year. Still, Barrasso says he remains concerned about undocumented workers voting.
You want to make sure that people who vote are actual citizens and are residents of the state in which they're voting, and I think there absolutely fraud occurs.
Many Democrats also want to set up a national holiday on Election Day in order to encourage wider turnout, but Barrasso doesn't like that idea either. Even though he says he likes high voter turnout.
You want everyone to vote. You want them to vote where they live. You want citizens to vote. It's a right that we all have, and you want to make sure people exercise it.
Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney says the legislation embodies Democrats' big government approach, and she says it's an overreach.
We have, a very important role for the states in our election process, and the last thing we should want to do is suck power away from the people.
Cheney also says the legislation is a thinly veiled attempt to make Democrats the permanent majority party.
This bill is not about making it easier for legitimate registered voters to vote. This bill is about keeping Democrats in office, it's about skewing our election process so that Democrats have an advantage, and it's about imposing government control over our fundamental constitutional rights, freedom of speech. So it's a dangerous bill, it's a bad bill.
Supporters say the legislation is an attempt to overhaul the nation's election laws in the wake of the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling that gave corporations the ability to spend unlimited amounts on elections. Former Wyoming Senator Al Simpson says something needs to be done about that.
Oh, anything to get rid of the Citizens United decision, which opened the door to unlimited amounts of money by anonymous people, which will eventually destroy the system.
And Simpson says he'd also be fine with having federal tax dollars go towards helping fund local elections.
Well, it sure as hell be better than this. At least you know who got what.
Simpson says the biggest problem with so much money in politics is that it's eroded trust in the nation's elected leaders.
It makes the guy on the bar stool in Cody, Wyoming, or Buffalo, or Moorcroft, it makes them say one thing. These guys are corrupt. They're getting money. And all you got to do is follow the money. Now, so you go look at their voting record, and it's pretty easy to follow the money.
Congresswoman Cheney says unlimited election spending is protected by the First Amendment and is a form of free speech. She says she can support some reforms, though, even if they're much more modest than what Democrats are pushing.
The solution is transparency. The solution is making sure that everybody knows who's contributing to people. The solution is ensuring that, if you make a campaign contribution, I think that, we ought to have a rule that you've got immediate disclosure. I think that would be an important step.
While H.R. 1 is Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Democrats' top priority, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said he's not even going to allow it to come up for a vote in his chamber. That means the legislation is as much about the 2020 presidential election as it is about fixing the nation's electoral process. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
This weekend, the Smithsonian Channel is premiering a new four-part series focused on Yellowstone National Park. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska spoke with Tom Wilson, the executive producer, and Eric Bendek, a producer and writer for the series, to get a behind-the-scenes look at how the wildlife-focused series was created. First, Bendek answers how the series tries to differentiate itself from other well-known Yellowstone stories.
One of the core ideas that I think we had going into the series was this sense that the same stories get told over and over and over again about Yellowstone, given that it's our backyard and we have, kind of a broader and more complex understanding of the ecosystem. We thought we could bring in stories that maybe hadn't been told as often or dive into stories in a different way than they had been told before. So that was kind of our unique access, just being here every day, having it right in our own backyard makes such a huge difference. And we just saw the potential there for new stories, new approaches, new ideas.
What are some of those new approaches, new ideas, new stories that you guys were thinking about from the start that ended up being in the series?
Often Yellowstone shows, like Eric's kind of alluding to, you try to be all Yellowstone in like 1 or 2 hours. So by doing 4 hours of natural history, we knew we were going to need to delve into other stories, and that was really exciting to us. So one thing that we really tried to emphasize was, what if these films could follow characters from the beginning to the end, where you're not just seeing a vignette of a different animal doing something remarkable, but you actually kind of get to live with them and see how their struggles get them through the year, the seasons. In our Sub-Zero show, we followed a bobcat that has been hunting waterfowl on the Madison River. Really being able to track that bobcat from the film, from the beginning and all the way to the end when it finally conquers the river, was a really exciting angle to be able to take to approach it at. In the bird show, Life on a Wing, we were able to interweave all different types of birds that inhabit Yellowstone and almost tell the stories that people are so quick to kind of brush over. But when you can get really intimate views into the nesting and rearing behavior of these different bird species and interweaving them together, it takes that whole bird life story to another level.
And how were you all able to find these perspectives?
Yellowstone, people have a sense of it that it is kind of like a safari park where you show up, you drive through, and you have all these experiences and encounters. But anyone who's been to Yellowstone knows it's way more challenging than that. You have to be very, very strategic about where you are, when you are there, exactly certain hours, certain days or weeks of the year. There's phenomena that's happening at no other time of the year. So learning really from the ground up all those core things about behavior, natural cycles, and following those through the year is just something that takes years and years. And Tom and I, even though Grizzly Creek has spent so much time in the field there, we're still learning new things every year, new behaviors every year. That just adds to our long history and knowledge there, but it is nothing like, you know, the safari type experience that you might expect.
And there was another key in having the four episodes from the outset over this production schedule is we could go out and maybe have a really great bird related encounter and know, okay, that's going to be great for the bird show. And then the next day we might have something with wolves and bears that we knew was going to go into our predator show. So having four films that we knew we were going to fill out allowed us to spend enough time and really be opportunistic in terms of what we were seeing and where that footage might go.
Obviously, there's challenges of filming in backcountry and in the wild. How did you overcome some challenges in the past 4 years working on this specific series?
In terms of camera equipment, batteries, our own gear to keep us warm and safe, it's definitely all a science that we're always getting better at it. I mean, I would do things differently the next time I went out. You always want to get better and better. And it's just been the many hours of doing it. You know, in terms of being in the backcountry, it's the same kind of safety protocols that you would use on any sort of backcountry experience. And then you just add to that the addition of all this camera equipment, which is highly technical, takes a lot of battery power. Especially when it gets cold, the batteries last a lot less, so you're kind of doubling up in the weight you're carrying and just battery bricks. And then everything's digital now. We're filming everything at really the highest quality that a digital camera can film it at. So you have a lot of data cards and you're constantly offloading your data at night and you're managing your hard drives. So it's amazing what the technology has allowed us to capture, but it also is pretty much a full-time job unto itself and just keeping all that technology working properly so that when the right moment arises, it's going to be captured.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska speaking with Tom Wilson, the executive producer, and Eric Bendick, a producer and writer for the series.
Coming up, grizzly bear experts say local public support comes from education. That and more here on Open Spaces. You are listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. The warming climate has some parts of the world tiptoeing on thin ice. And for ice fishermen, that's no metaphor. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards went out with some longtime Wyoming fishermen who gave her some tips on staying safe on the ice as temperatures heat up.
On a pond in a top secret spot on the Laramie Plains, I take my first steps out onto the ice behind fisherman Larry Foyanini. He tells me to walk right behind him. He points out some open water in the middle where a spring percolates, keeping it from freezing.
We don't want to be in this area at all down there.
Are you kind of looking at the color of the ice and seeing stuff?
Well, it's so clear you can see through it down here.
You can see how far down those bubbles are?
Yeah, you can see straight in. This is nice and clear. But there's some big cracks here. That kind of freaks me out.
Oh, cracks are always there.
Their cracks are
ice
always here?
Ice expands when it freezes. Water does, and it has to crack.
Foyanini starts drilling a hole with an auger in the ice to make sure it's thick enough to fish on. He sticks his boot down in the hole and feels the thickness with his toe. 4 inches is recommended, but Foyanini says this pond is a foot thick, and we're safe to fish. His friend, Guy Scarpelli, drags a sled out with the fishing gear. Soon, we've got some balls of Velveeta cheese on hooks, and Foyanini sits in a chair twitching them to attract fish. While we wait, Scarpelli tells me about an accident he had out here a few years back.
Well, I was right over there, and I didn't realize I was getting closer to where the spring had been, and the ice wasn't very thick. Next thing I knew, I fell through. And the thing that saved me was having Larry with me.
Yeah.
We lost the auger and everything.
Really? Whoop. How did you get him out?
I just laid out, flattened myself out on the ice where I was really flat, so I was distributing the weight and I inched over towards him, and it still took us about 5-10 minutes
to really
finally got a leg up where I could grab it.
Neither of these guys is new to the sport either. Scarpelli started fishing on Seminole Reservoir near Rollins when he was a little kid back in the 1950s, but he says the sport has changed since then.
It's a shorter season, yes, and I ice fished on April 23rd and still had 16 inches of ice. But I've also seen it where, like last year, I didn't feel that we were safe enough to go out fishing.
Foyanini agrees. He grew up in Rock Springs and remembers getting on the ice in October. Now he says he's lucky if it's December. Meteorologist Sean Sublett worked on a report called On Thin Ice for the research group Climate Central. He says that's because fall is lasting longer than it once did.
We don't get the extreme cold as much as we used to.
Cheyenne used to feel the bite of 25 below pretty regularly, but Sublett says it hasn't dropped that low since 1990.
We're seeing a little bit of a delay in Arctic air kind of coming into the Rocky Mountains. I see delay in terms of, you know, some of these colder outbreaks would begin to settle in late October or November, and now they're waiting into later November or December.
Rocky Mountain winter is now as much as 3 degrees warmer than it was a century and a half ago. Nighttime, when ice forms fastest, has warmed up 5 degrees in that time. Sublett says some lakes that used to freeze, like around Salt Lake City, they just don't anymore. He says such trends make ice more dangerous to walk or drive a truck on for fishing.
With the ice not getting as thick, it's a little more risky. Unfortunately, you know, you fall through that ice and you're into that just hideously cold water, and, you know, hypothermia can set in a matter of minutes.
The Wyoming Game and Fish Department's Sarah Dorenzo has some advice for safer ice fishing. Look at the color.
Clear ice is much stronger than cloudy or white ice. Cloudy or white ice means that it's been frozen and then thawed and refrozen, and that can create some instability because of air bubbles or frozen snow. And so if you are fishing on white ice, we recommend double the thickness of 8 inches.
She says people should never try to ice fish alone and should make sure that they take some essential safety gear.
Ice picks, we recommend a life jacket in some cases, and definitely packing extra clothes and hot liquids in case there is an ice fishing accident.
She also says not to fish on places like streams or rivers with a current flowing underneath because that ice is even less stable. Meanwhile, out on the pond, a fishing pole goes crazy. Someone has nabbed our cheese. Foyanini lets me do the honors.
Okay, whoa. Lift him out.
Okay.
All the way out.
Whoa.
Oh, your first fish.
What do I do?
Just lay him on the ground.
Lay him on the ground?
Yeah. That's a rainbow.
The ice might be getting less reliable, but the trout are still down there swimming. Scarpelli, for one, isn't giving up anytime soon.
Here, fishy, 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 fishy.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Bet you're going fishing all of the time. Baby going fishing too. Bet your life, your sweet wife, catch more fish than you.
A California condor recently flew from Arizona to Wyoming, but died shortly after arriving. California condors are an endangered species. The bird was being tracked and was taken in for a necropsy by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. After that, the University of Wyoming Museum of Vertebrates was given the body for research and education. Wyoming Public Radio's London Homer Wambeam sat down with the museum's curator and collections manager, Elizabeth Womack, to find out more about the condor.
The condor coming to Wyoming is significant for a couple different reasons. The first one is for the fact that we're not supposed to have condors here sort of within modern history. So condors' range was restricted at the early part of the 20th century to Southern California. We know that they were in Arizona. There are written accounts from European settlers who'd seen them down in Arizona. But there had been no written accounts of them at that time period up in Wyoming. There is some questionable accounts of them, and there are no Pleistocene records from them here. So at the same time, there's no reason it couldn't have come here. They're restricted to sort of mountain ranges where there are large open plains that they can scavenge for food, which sounds really similar to Wyoming. The other reason that it's really interesting that that bird particular came here is because it's from the released population. And so our bird was bred in a zoo in Oregon, and then she was released in northern Arizona, and she made her way away from that population. And they're fairly social birds. And she sort of went on a wander journey, and she came all the way up north to us. And there is one other condor that's known from that population, an adult female who wandered up into sort of out of Utah into the very southern tip of Wyoming and then sort of wandered back down, and she bred and was absolutely fine. But this bird didn't come up from Utah. She must have come up from Colorado and like came around and hang out in Medicine Bow.
So condors are pretty rare and were actually considered extinct at one point. What's the reason for the decline in their population?
So California condors, it's a really unique species. They're a humongous bird. They're the largest flying bird in North America, the second largest flying bird in the New World. And they are sometimes what people call a Pleistocene relic. There were many more condors, and we believe that they fed off of the megafauna that was there. They're an iconic species. They really sort of represent, it's fascinating reading the accounts of explorers in Southern California, even people who've spent a lot of the time out there. They say the minute you see a condor is like the one most amazing minute of your day, your month, or your year. They are somewhat tied to large areas of dead game. They are a scavenger species. So, you know, the lack of the megafauna, the die-off of the large bison herds and such, they've sort of constricted to the coastline. And so they eat a lot of the marine mammals that wash up there. They'll also eat things. There's records of them eating salmon on the salmon runs up in Oregon and Washington. They'll eat, you know, down to jackrabbit size prey. The other really interesting thing and why they're so important is they're kind of being used as sort of a indicator species. So one of the reasons they're having such a hard time reintroducing them is they're falling prey to a lot of lead poisoning. And a lot of the work on the condors have shown that when a hunter kills or a game warden or something kills an animal with a lead-based shot, it turns out they fraction a lot. And the x-rays are amazing. It looks literally like a little snowstorm in the animal. So what happens is you clean out your gut pile. And if you leave your gut pile there, scavengers are going to come to it. And it turns out they're consuming a lot of lead. So a lot of the work going on with that has started with the California condors, trying to figure out how can we reintroduce this iconic species and make them viable.
Once this condor made it to Wyoming, it died. And there was a lot of concern over the reasons it died. Why was it taken so seriously? What were those concerns?
So I think people were worried first off that maybe something man-made resulted in its death. Some of the other introduced birds have hit power lines. There was no record of anyone hitting it with a car. I think somebody would notice that they hit a condor with a car. But, you know, what if it flew into a fence line? I think people were worried that something we did here in Wyoming caused this bird to die. And because it was only the second record, and really when the call came out that she was there, people were so excited that she was. And I think a lot of our hopes were that she would fly out of the state, grow up, and then come back and sort of start, you know, maybe visit us again. So we were worried that it was man-made was the cause of her death. And it turns out it wasn't. So something to do with her neurological system, they think, went wrong.
So what's the end of this bird's story? What's going to happen with her body?
She's now become a specimen at the University of Wyoming Museum of Vertebrates. So we got special permission from the federal government to house her here. It's amazing to have her here. And truthfully, while her life has stopped, her use, her future is not. It's going to continue on. That means people can come here and they can study how large and what shape a California condor wing looks like compared to other birds of prey that come here in Wyoming. They can look at her bone structure. How is her skull different than, say, like a red-tailed hawk or a turkey vulture? School students can come and do art projects associated with her. Genetic researchers can come and ask us for a subsample of that tissues. So essentially, her life after death will probably never stop.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's London Homer Wambeam speaking with museum curator Elizabeth Womack. You can see photos of the condor when it first arrived in Wyoming on wyomingpublicmedia.org.
This past year has been turbulent for the greater Yellowstone grizzly bear. It was returned to the threatened species list last fall, shortly after the state made plans to begin a grizzly hunt. With the bear's continued uncertain status, people who live in grizzly habitat are frustrated, and some grizzly experts are fearful that the bear is losing support from its neighbors. As Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska reports, those experts say local support is vital.
A lot of things have happened in the last year that have confused the public.
That's Dan Thompson. He's in charge of large carnivores for the Wyoming Game and Fish Department, and he says it's important to keep the public educated about the grizzlies.
I hope we can try to get rid of some of the myths and try to increase people's understanding of all the work that's been done to recover grizzly bears.
Thompson, along with four other grizzly bear experts representing Idaho, Montana, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, recently spoke to a public audience that's passionate about grizzlies. One of the questions, what are one of the biggest threats to the grizzlies that currently exist? To Hillary Cooley with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the answer is simple.
I think for me, it's public support for bears. I think on multiple fronts, you know, folks that are dealing with bears and dealing with conflicts that we cannot seem to delist when we get to recovery. I think that's number one.
The biggest threat in preserving grizzly bears on the landscape is keeping and gaining support from the public. Cooley says it's been frustrating, especially for people who have been living in grizzly habitat and have seen the populations grow.
People take matters into their own hands. It's real easy to do, and they're doing it.
Yeah.
Cooley did not elaborate on what that means, but it's clear local support for protecting the bear seems to be waning. Toby Boudreau is with the Idaho Fish and Wildlife Department. He says this is part of the challenge that local officials now face.
You cannot deny somebody's emotional, you know, feelings about an animal or a resource issue or anything. So, but I think facts help inform the discussion.
That includes local managers educating residents and outdoor enthusiasts how to share habitat as the grizzly population grows. For example, making sure to have bear deterrent trash cans, secure bird food, and electric fences around gardens and fruit-bearing trees. And to make noise and carry bear spray when you're in grizzly habitat. For bear managers, these are proven solutions. Once again, Toby Boudreau.
I've always found that if you don't give people the facts, society makes up stuff to fill the gap. So I think it's imperative for agencies to do that.
The goal is to remind people that they can coexist with grizzlies even when their protected status remains uncertain. Chris Sheets was the mastermind behind the event and co-founder of the podcast Right to Roam. He says this type of interaction on a controversial subject is important.
I really believe that if the human condition is given a chance, when people are sat face to face, you can see that magic kind of happen. I think that we saw that. People sat back, opened up their ears, opened up their mind, and kind of we're forced to rethink some things.
But Sheets says this is certainly not the end of the discussion.
In order for that to be a much more informed conversation with more depth and more nuance, we're going to have to put on a few more events, I think.
Especially as grizzly bears start to come out of hibernation this month with new conflicts on the horizon. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Up next, the public helps to find out more about the moose population in southeastern Wyoming, and one Wyoming-born artist is using his home state as inspiration for his work. This is Open Spaces. You're tuned in to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. In wide open spaces, like the rural parts of the Mountain West, there's sometimes little known about the secret lives of plants and animals. There are too many square miles and too few scientists. That's where citizen scientists can come to the rescue. Wyoming Public Radio's Mackie Mullen checked out their role in surveying moose in one corner of Wyoming.
If you've ever looked around the place where you live and made some kind of observation about the natural world, and you're well on your way to becoming a citizen scientist.
Citizen science is when scientists enlist volunteers to help conduct scientific research.
That's Zoe Nelson. She works at the Barry Biodiversity Institute on the University of Wyoming's campus. The institute runs citizen science projects all over the state. Here's how it works.
Scientists ask a question, design a protocol, and then we work with them to help recruit volunteers, retain volunteers, and answer that question through collecting field data.
Which brings us to the moose survey. Wyoming's Game and Fish Department has a job for some citizen scientists and wants to know more about the animal in the Snowy Mountain Range in southeastern Wyoming. But before volunteers are sent out into the field, they need to know what to look for. Alex May is a graduate student in zoology and physiology and gave the training this year. For starters, it included where to look.
In this area, they're really closely tied to river corridors and aspen stands. So if you're going up in the mountains, you know, trying to stay near streams or rivers is a really good first step.
And if a citizen scientist spots a moose on their route, May says there are particular data points they're supposed to collect.
Where they see the moose, what the sex is, so is it a male or female, approximate age, and then whether there's a calf or two even with the female.
The bulk of the training is being able to get an idea for those things just by looking at the moose. For example, adult females will have a white blaze mark on their rump, and males will have antlers or exposed bone of the skull depending on the time of year. May says it's also important to look for signs of things that may be hurting the moose population.
The arterial worm and the winter tick are two parasites that moose can have that you can sometimes see evidence of.
Like ears that look as if they've been snipped off on top, or big patches of bare skin and hair that has turned white. If a citizen scientist doesn't see any moose on Moose Day, that's just as important. Zoe Nelson says no data is still data.
Zero is a number in science, and I think that that is also a really cool kind of statement to help hopefully draw deeper connections into the scientific process.
Zero is a number citizen scientist Ken Zajac and his hiking buddy Bob Kubicek are familiar with. I've met up with them for their ninth Moose Day.
Did you mention to Maggie that we've been doing this for however many years and we've never seen a moose yet?
We're in Kubicek's truck, headed to Vitavu, an area of rocky outcrops within the Medicine Bow Route National Forest. It's about 20 miles outside of Laramie. Soon after we hit a gravel road, we come to a gate meant to stop vehicles.
The seasonal closure. Stop here and walk.
Yep, that's it.
The 5-mile route we'll hike today has been predetermined by the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. It selects about 30 different routes in southeastern Wyoming twice a year for Moose Day. Then, volunteers sign up for the route of their choosing to hike on a date that is also predetermined. Kubicek says they got involved with Moose Day back when it started in 2015.
That was the first I'd ever heard of the whole citizen science idea.
His buddy, Ken Zajac, says it's also a good excuse to get outside.
Especially out here in Wyoming. We got some of the last good stuff left.
We've made it to the part of the route that's surrounded by willows. Kubicek says that's prime moose habitat.
So pretty deluxe place to eat, you know, buffet.
Soon we come around a bend and stop right in our tracks. We stay as quiet as we can because just to the left of the trail, about 30 yards away, we've spotted a moose. It's pretty big and it doesn't have a white patch on its rump, so we guess that it's an adult male. We stand there for a while, the moose looking at us looking at him, then it disappears back into the trees.
Well, finally.
Yes.
Always great to see a moose, always.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
The American West has inspired countless artists. That holds especially true for one prominent artist from the region. Gabe Leonard is a Gillette native who calls himself the cinematic artist. His canvases feature noir scenes of cowboys, saloon girls, and gangsters. And his collectors have a style to match, among them Quentin Tarantino. Leonard frequently returns to Wyoming to reimmerse himself in its landscape and culture. During his most recent visit, Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler sat down with him to talk about his artworks and their beginnings.
So how did you first start out?
I was working at Macy's folding shirts for minimum wage, which is the only job I could find, and struggling to get by. And I went with a roommate of mine down in the boardwalk at Venice Beach one day and saw some artists selling their artwork down there. And it kind of dawned on me that if they can be doing this, so could I. So I got my portfolio, went down to the boardwalk, laid out a blanket on the ground and set up my stuff. And I made $9. Some color copies from Kinko's that I made. It cost me $6 to park, but it was still profitable, a $3 profit. It was kind of a proof of concept, like, maybe I can make a few bucks, and I needed all the few bucks I could get.
Was there any moment that you were selling your art on the pier or on the ground, and you thought, I just can't do this anymore? Like you really wanted to give up?
I had nothing to give up to. There was no backup plan. This was the only thing that worked for me. There was no job that paid better. So if I didn't make money selling it that way, I'd have to figure out how to do it somewhere else. So there was never a thought that I would be able to quit. It's like, how do I quit having brown hair?
What is it about the cowboy or Western America? What about that is connecting with you, and why is it coming through in your art?
Well, a lot of that comes from growing up in Wyoming. And when I started doing the outlaw stuff, I was in my early 30s. At the time, I was also interested in history, and I was reading up and studying a lot of the American history, and especially in the West and around where I grew up. And growing up here, I didn't appreciate it at the time. I wasn't really interested in what happened here. And I started imagining what it would be like to be in Wyoming in the late 1800s, with no electricity, no running water. So I thought, what if I created these characters that had that rough sort of attitude about themselves? And I drew upon just my own experience of people I grew up with, the environment that I grew up in, and I sort of put that into those paintings. I wasn't really angling to have Western art. I wanted it to have that as a sort of a theme that was going on, but I wanted it to, the main thrust of it to be the personalities and the attitudes of the people that were there.
So how has your work changed from then to now?
The work was really more focused on referencing from specific historical characters and people. And I think my work now, especially in the outlaw Wild West genre, is more metaphorical. If you'd have an American mythology, that would be more of what it is. I think the Western cowboy character is something that's uniquely American. So I use those things as a storytelling device, or maybe a philosophical point of view, without overburdening somebody with a bunch of high and mighty, points of view. So there's a lot of ambiguity in what I put into the work as far as the storylines, and so people can read what they want to read into it.
And you're from Gillette. Why is it important for you to come back here every so often?
It helps me to reconnect with those memories and those ideas. The farther you get away from your past, the more you romanticize it and you forget things. So just coming back, especially when I come back in the winter, it helps. It reminds me of what it was like to be here, and things you forget, the way the snow looks, the different types of snow, the smells, all those sort of things. And that goes into any part of creating the artwork. The more connection I can have to it, the better and deeper the work becomes.
How do you see your work evolving in the future?
I'm always looking for better ways to do things, more efficient ways. I do lots of things besides all the outlaw and Wild West stuff. I'm working on an idea that involves people doing tough jobs, I've tentatively called it grit, which involves some of the oil field workers that I've painted recently, and the coal trucks and mines. And I'm looking to do some firefighters and Forest Service characters and stuff. I'm always interested in broadening the horizons of what I do. One thing I don't really want to do is be pigeonholed into doing, just Western stuff, because if you do something like that, anything for too long, for too much, you can burn out with it and get tired of your own work. And so I'm trying to keep The main goal is to keep things fresh and interesting for me, and find things to do that allow me to learn more about what's going on around me or more about myself.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler speaking with artist Gabe Leonard. Thanks so much for joining us for Open Spaces. You can hear today's show again and listen to all our stories at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
That's where you can drop us a line with any good story ideas and sign up for the Open Spaces podcast. We always appreciate your ratings and comments as well.
You can support the great reporting you hear on Open Spaces and every day on Wyoming Public Radio by making a donation. You can do that on our website, too.
Person in charge of that website is Anna Rader. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.